Rich Dunn Sales calling.
Hey, John. Thank you for calling on time. You're keeping this to a... can you tell me about the where they approached you, the folks at Cine Family, and you're going to be out here to do some appearances when your films show at this 80s retrospective thing?
Yeah, I'll probably introduce the films and do Q&As afterwards. And, I'm already out here because I'm also, my bread job is being a screenwriter for hire. And
yep.
So I'm out doing the usual screenwriter thing of pitching television series ideas to people and, stuff like that.
So I take it you're, like most people of talent and vision in this business, you're seeing the bounty today is in long-form cable and not in features because it's friendlier to people like yourself.
Yeah, I would say that, it's not easy to get something made, but what you hear a lot today is, that's a nice idea, but it's not noisy enough.
Yeah.
So even long-form television, has to be pretty, it helps if there's zombies or vampires or a lot of murders or kinky sex or something like that. But they are interested in stuff that features just aren't interested in anymore. I think Hollywood is a business, and to a certain extent, what can the United States film industry do that nobody else can do? They can do $150 million special effects movies.
Other
countries just don't have the capital or the infrastructure to do that. So in terms of competition, you have to, now that it's an international business, you have to look, well what sells well overseas, and if we're going to make a low budget movie, it should be kind of a slacker comedy which may not travel but doesn't cost that much.
John, I think I know what you care about, and it's a very cynical thing you've just said. You're you're being frank, but it's very depressing to hear you say this.
Well, let's just say things change. So there was a point, before there was television, where among the things that Hollywood made were soap operas. They made movies that were basically, kind of weepy, kind of soap opera things, and they made family dramas, and they made a huge range of things.
Mm-hmm.
When television came along, a lot of those genres just kind of disappeared from feature films because they didn't need to make them anymore. People could get them at home, and all they had to do was put up with a certain number of commercials.
Mm-hmm.
So for somebody to go to a movie theater and pay the, it's different in different parts of the country, but, $8 to $15 and, have to park their car and all that kind of stuff, it has to be something they really, really want to see, because if they wait 6 months, it will be on their television.
Yeah.
It will be in the stream. So what can you do that's going to be...
Yeah.
spectacular enough that it gets people out of their houses and they go to a theater, and the Hollywood, and there's not really that much left of it. That's what they're trying to figure out. And so independent films, which in the 80s there was a little bit of a business for a while, it's pretty rare that they get a theatrical release anymore.
Mm. You have, we all, filmmakers all commonly refer to their films as children, and you love your children equally in different ways, but they're all your children. But do you have any kind of a standout special affection for any of your 80s films? I personally, I can't remember. Is 8 Men Out part of the retrospective?
No, they're not showing it this time.
That's my favorite.
I'd say for me, it's the experiences that I have more or less fondness for.
Okay.
Of where did we shoot it, and what was it like working there, and who was on the crew, and of course now, as years pass, you look at movies, and there's people who were in the movies who are no longer living.
Yeah.
So there's that kind of home movie part of it for somebody who made movies.
Yeah.
But Mate One was a special experience because of working with the people in West Virginia. And,
yeah.
You know, some of the other movies were harder and just not much fun to be in the place.
Yeah.
But, you know, we made a movie called Sunshine State, and we got to live on the beach in Florida.
Mm-hmm.
No one can beat that. You know, yeah. It was just everybody, actors and crew were just having a great time.
Mm. You're kind of in front as far as directors using African American actors in significant roles. I was thinking particularly of Brother from Another Planet, and as you know, right now the whole conversation is that there's a whiteness that needs to be kind of corrected. Certainly on the Academy membership level, what do you stand on that? Do you believe that that's the rule change is? You know, it's interesting because some folks people who were coming up in the 70s and 80s, some of them like Charlotte Rampling and they're not exactly like gung ho like Spielberg. Gung ho on the rules. They think that maybe some people are getting penalized for just being older. It doesn't mean they're necessarily racial minded. What's your general feeling about this?
You know, it's not meant to be a democracy. You know, in some ways, it's interesting because once you're in the Academy voters, mm-hmm. it is more democratic than like the Independent Spirit Awards, where the nominees are chosen by a committee. But getting it's like a club membership, you know. And so the Academy is a club mm-hmm. that's having to decide, like any country club that used to not even include Jews or blacks or whatever.
Yeah.
We may change our rules now. Is there something that do we want actually to make sure we have more black members? What are we going to do as outreach?
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it's kind of up to the Academy to do that. But you know, they're not meant to be the most democratic thing in the world. They're a club,
yeah.
And it's their club award ceremony.
Mm-hmm.
I do think that one of the things is, as I was saying before, just the economics of it. They kind of look around and they say, okay, well, it seems like we're having a harder time selling, black-themed movies around the rest of the world. So do we really want to risk that much money on them and everything?
Mm-hmm.
And then finally, it also gets down to who are the executives and what are they personally interested in?
Yeah.
And what they're personally interested in, is probably a little less skewed toward women and a lot less skewed toward minorities.
Yeah.
That's what interests them.
Yeah.
We've had this interesting phenomenon with a lot of our movies, something like City of Hope, which is playing in this retrospective,
mm-hmm.
Where when the company that was going to distribute it made a trailer, there were no black people in it. And over half of the main characters in the movie are African American.
Yeah.
And we said, where'd all the people go? And they hadn't even noticed. And this often happens when our movies get reviewed. I made a movie called Casa de los Babies, and half of the characters, more than half the characters, are Hispanic and speak Spanish.
Mm-hmm.
And none of the reviews mentioned any of those people.
So what we're saying is that that racism is not a thorny, belligerent feeling, but it's a very subtle thing that lives beneath our skins, and we don't even know when we're exuding it.
I think it's a way of seeing the world, and if you've grown up seeing the world one way, it's very, very hard to see it in another one. And it's kind of the point of the movie Brother from Another Planet, is let's go to Harlem, and let's have a guide who is kind of accepted as somebody there because, his skin is dark, but he knows less about Harlem than we do, even if we're white or we're black and we've never been to Harlem or anything. Like, he's from another planet.
Right.
He doesn't know how anything works. At one point he even takes his eyeball out, and it watches something.
Yeah.
I just think it's something that as the world changes, people have to catch up with it.
Yeah.
And it's something you have to always be conscious of. For me, my last movie, the leads in the movie were Edward James Olmos and two African American actresses.
Gopher Sisters.
It was Gopher Sisters.
Right.
But none of the movie was really about race.
Mm-hmm.
Those were the actors who I just thought, well, here's an interesting story. Mm. And, you know, finally there's a detective thing, and there's this thing about friendship, and, you know, and then the Chinese are the, you know, kind of people who are mysterious in it, because they're the people who are smuggling people into the country. And from a Chinese point of view, it's like, how come our characters, only one of them got to talk? You know?
Yeah.
So one movie can't do everything, but you can kind of look around you and say, what's going around in the world? And is the movies I've been making, is the books I've been writing or whatever, deal with what's in that world?
I'd like to just try and draw you into a thing that I thought was fascinating about the, you know, basically the politically correct notion that things have to be quotaed and sort of made right, you know, a quota system. Jen Yamato of The Daily Beast did an interview with Joel and Ethan Coen not too long ago, and she was basically taking the view that why is Hail Caesar so white? Why didn't you have more, you know, actors of color? And my answer would be, they thought it was ridiculous, but my answer would be, look at any movie made in 1951, or look at read any book about the way Hollywood was in the early 50s. All people of color were regarded as baggage handlers, porters, cooks, maids, you know. So there's nobody, this is about...
Watch a Preston Sturges movie, and there's the porter bugging his eyes out.
Yeah.
That was what people thought was funny.
That guy was pretty funny in Sullivan's Travels. That was a brilliant comedian, whoever that was, that guy in the...
Yeah.
Anyway, if you were to really be on board with, we gotta like change this, we gotta bring the industry, you would cast Hail Caesar with significant people of color in lead roles in order to just represent the way we think things should have been then and should be now. Forget historical accuracy, which is what...
No, you know, finally, I think, you know, theater got into, you know, blind casting for a while, and...
Hamilton! Have you seen Hamilton? You're a New Yorker still, right?
Yeah, no, I'm actually out here, but I know Hamilton.
You live out here?
Yeah, no, I'm out here pitching movies.
But, I mean, but you live in Manhattan, right?
Oh, yeah. You know, and for years, Shakespeare has been kind of all over the place. You know, it doesn't matter. You know, and obviously, you know, when you're doing Julius Caesar, nobody's an old Roman.
Yeah.
You know, there's Italians, there's Germans, there's Dutch, there's, you know, Puerto Ricans, there's black people, and that's fine. But if you're doing something that's very specific to the time, for instance, when I made Eight Men Out, there's one black guy with lines in the whole movie, and he's a guy who works at Comiskey Park, and he makes a crack, you know, when the you know, reporters that me and Stud Sterkel played say, so what do you think of his team? He says, yeah, they're pretty good for white boys.
Yeah.
But that's how much black people got to be in that story in real life, and it would have been inappropriate to, you know, what is going to be a black player in 1919 playing in the major leagues? Didn't happen.
Yeah.
You know, and you know, so well, I think what you have to do, though, is look at the whole. You know, is there a filmmaker who's never had, you know, I know a black actor who was in a Woody Allen movie, and he got stopped trying to get on the set because the production assistants thought he was scamming them, you know, because there'd never been a black actor with a line in a Woody Allen movie, you know, and there have been very few since.
What Woody Allen movie are you talking of? What are you speaking of? Which movie?
I think it was there's a little montage in the one where Mia Farrow gets amnesia. I forget the name of the movie.
Okay.
And there's like one black actor who gets to speak.
Yeah.
James McDaniel.
Okay.
And that's it for the movie. And, you know, and it's pretty rare.
Mm.
But that's Woody Allen's world.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and truly, that's the world of the people that he talks about. There aren't many black people in it.
You know, if I were at HBO and I was looking to find someone to write and direct a movie about the currently unfolding, just begun saga of the Republicans blocking any consideration of a Supreme Court judge. I would definitely be asking you if you would be interested in that, because this is you weave in social currents, and your films always are about the way. I would love to see you take a crack at this, and it's just starting right now, but it's a fascinating.
Oh, yeah. It usually takes about 10 to 12 years, like The Big Short, which I thought was a very good movie. Mm-hmm. It takes a while for that information to get out of those closed rooms. And some of it has never, there's a movie to be made if anybody was willing to talk about the meeting between the government and the guys who ran those banks, where the guys who ran those banks said, if you try to put us in jail, we'll bring the world economy down, and we can.
Yeah.
So what are we talking about here?
Yeah.
There's stuff that never comes out, or it comes out, certainly doesn't come out in time to do anything about it.
Yeah.
It'll be interesting to see. And it's what I want, and I think you could make a pretty good comedy about it, is the first guy who Obama calls and says, well, here's the deal. How would you like to have investigators looking back into everything you've done ever in your life? Mm-hmm. Any scandal will be, and then at the end of it, you're not going to get the job. I mean, that's what you're asking.
That's what
whoever the first, you're cannon fodder. And you're my good buddy, so you're going to do it.
Yeah. Well, he could. Someone was talking yesterday about it's conceivable that he could do a recess appointment, just plop them in there. That's.
Yeah, and they'll try to block that. But then, I think that's what he should be doing. He wasted his whole first 4 years trying to be reasonable. it's like, come on, what do you have to lose now?
Yeah.
Bring it to a fight. Get it out there.
He did really waste so much time. I got so angry with him for keep talking about nonpartisan and about trying to work with people. I said, "Can you wake up?"
Yeah, look around you. You're surrounded by people who would rather have the country fail than you succeed.
Yeah.
You just gotta forget about those people and do what you can without them.
Yeah.
Or just keep taking it to them and make them say the words. No, we don't want this. No, we don't want this. And explain why.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not the nature of the guy, and that's not how he got where he got. As I've done a lot of things that have dealt with presidential politics in the past, and pretty much that's what you see is that the first 4 years are people just kind of figuring out the job. Even Franklin Roosevelt, but he got to stay in for, almost four terms, so he got really good at it.
Yeah. Well, so you're not thinking, and there's no real talk. How about doing a small film for... shot digitally. Obviously, it's much more inexpensive. Is there any, you have no interest in trying for the feature realm anymore? Or is that just pretty much closed to you? Or what do you...
I continue to write features and try to get them made. It's just that we haven't been able to raise the money for them.
Yeah.
Right now, we're working on a movie that I've written called To Save the Man that's set at the Carlisle Indian School in 1890. Which is, if people know that school, it's because Jim Thorpe eventually went there.
Okay.
And it was the template for all the Native American boarding schools. And the title comes from the founder of the school, Richard Henry Pratt, who was a military man, who was in his day not just a liberal, was a progressive. But his catchphrase was, "To save the man, we must kill the Indian."
Huh.
In other words, we have to destroy their culture because that's what's holding them back. So here's, a place that was kind of the Harvard and the Alcatraz of Native Americans.
Yeah.
It's where the pan-Indian movement started and stuff like that. But a lot of people committed suicide and were torn away from their parents and were being taught to despise their own culture. So it's this very conscious cultural genocide that's going on at the same time that, it's a high school movie, and there were boys and girls together for the first time who would never have met each other, and so it's kind of Dead Poet Society, you know, for Native American. Well, you know, it's not an easy thing to raise money for, so, you know, we're out there stumping for that.
All right, John. Well,
I don't get many feature offers just as a writer anymore, because, you know, those are mostly those big franchise pictures, I just don't think I'm on that list anymore.
Well, I think you're a very valuable and valued person with a real brand, and I will always respect it and admire it, and I'll be dropping by to say hello when you drop by the Cine Family.
Great.
And
I'll see you there, Jeffrey.
All right, John. Thank you for taking the time. Appreciate it.
Yeah. Thanks. Bye now.
Okay.